post-Halloween treats.
Oh, Sage.
I'm supposed to tell you, you won the bet.
Did I?
You won the pool, and they actually gave me something to give you.
Really?
Yes. So you guessed that you were right on it, guessing the birth weight. So congratulations. Okay, I just had a question about the paper for your project. And yeah, reference the page number. That shouldn't be there, so I apologize. Just put the title of your project. That's all you have to do. When we started doing this, we took ideas from the back of an older version of the textbook, and we don't do that anymore, so I'll clean that up.
Okay.
Are there any other questions about class or anything at this point?
The paper, did you want an abstract with it?
No. You can just do the paper.
So does the paper have to be 2 to 4 pages or 3 to 4 pages?
3 to 4 is better.
Okay.
To try to get it all in 2, sometimes you just can't do that.
Okay. It just said.
Yeah. I apologize.
No, that's okay.
You know, I appreciate when you guys point that stuff out, because, you know, you look at things over and over and you think you've done it, and then, so what I need to do is write sticky notes to myself and stick them somewhere. Yes.
It says you have to have 3 references or more than 3, okay?
Yes.
Okay, good.
Yeah. You need a minimum of 3. If you have more than 3, that's great, but a minimum. So.
Oh, no.
Okay, just doing a little maintenance. Okay. Yes, Laura.
Is there a time frame for our presentations?
So your presentations, when we schedule them that morning, it'll be, you know, groups A and B or C and D are together. And, you know, it's really a fun morning. You get to have a potluck. And most people, if they allow about 10 to 15 minutes, that doesn't mean you're going to be talking the whole time, but you know, you get up there and you get set up and you tell about your project and then you give your information. And usually everyone's got some comments or questions for you, and then we need to get you down in the next group up. So that's usually works out pretty well, and we finish up by around noon the day of the presentations.
I believe on the rubric there's some sort of points about going too long on the presentation or not.
I've never taken points off for somebody going too long, and honestly, it's just I can't give you scientific evidence, but everybody seems to go somewhere between 10 and 20 minutes, and it's just one of those things that it all works out. So if you go over a little bit because you've got a lot of good information, I will not deduct.
I feel like this is a dumb question, but when you say 3 to 4 pages, are you excluding the title page and the
just the actual body of the paper. So it should be. All right, so as long as we're kind of at this point, so remember, no class next Monday because we get that day off. Tomorrow is election day. If you haven't already voted, I hope you will exercise that right and go vote again. It's never my job to tell you how to vote or what to do, but I have felt strongly about this my whole life. I think as nurses, we need to be involved. And honestly, it will affect you in your job. It'll affect your family. So it is important to pay attention. And with that, I'll get over my public service announcement because we are all sick of political ads. So let's talk about high blood pressure. And hopefully nobody will have high blood pressure by the time the election is done. So, all right. So we're going to talk about PIH, health, preeclampsia, eclampsia, etc. And hopefully by the end of the day or by the end of time, you're going to have a pretty good feel for it. Wow, that is really big. I got this weird view.
It's so boring. The entire thing. There's a lot of words.
Is that okay? So the thing to remember about high blood pressure during pregnancy is it can develop during pregnancy or develop postpartum hypertension. And it's still considered, you know, PIH, pregnancy-induced hypertension, or preeclampsia. Rarely have I ever seen anyone with an actual diagnosis of eclampsia, either during or after pregnancy, but that possibility still exists. And so that's why we really always say that we need to see these women 4 to 6 weeks postpartum. And so the other thing is we're seeing more and more adults who are, I really hate that light. I'm going to stand over here. I'm afraid I'm going to, you know, get blinded and trip over the table. Anyway, I was at a workshop on Friday in Bozeman, and they had a cord on the floor, and the guy was talking, and all of a sudden he was there, and then he wasn't. Anyway, of course, then I walked up there, and I about did the same thing, so anyway. But the thing about, now I got myself off track, but you need to remember is we're seeing more and more younger adults with hypertension. And the problem with that is, a lot of times young adults don't go to the doctors often, they're healthy, and so again, they're those kind of people walking around with that silent hypertension. And then, you know, if it's a female and she comes in pregnant, now suddenly we're dealing with hypertension on top of pregnancy. So again, it's going to speak to, it would really be great if we lived in the perfect world to have everybody come in for those preconception screenings, but that doesn't happen. So again, just remember it can develop at any point. We consider it to be a chronic hypertensive disorder if it precedes pregnancy or develops before 20 weeks of gestation. Okay. So there's a lot of nomenclature and a little bit of distinction in this lecture, but hopefully by the end I'll have that all ironed out for everybody. And it's not uncommon to see a woman who has chronic hypertension and then during pregnancy gets a superimposed preeclampsia, okay? So then our management, excuse me, is gonna be a little bit different. Right now we're saying it complicates about 5 to 10% of all pregnancies, but again, I think like the numbers of diabetes, I think that's gonna rise. And you will often see, and you know, now that we're at this point, and of course, unfortunately, now you're just probably feeling like you're really getting the hang of OB and feeling comfortable and it's all coming together, and now we're gonna finish clinical. It's always a bummer. But if you look, you probably will start noticing, or if you haven't already, a lot of times if it's someone with gestational diabetes, they've often got hypertension to go along with it. So these are really complex patients to manage, but honestly, they're what makes working an OB so interesting, too. So anybody who thinks they're gonna work an OB and never use med-surg again, I would challenge that viewpoint. I just put up there, it's been increasing by 1% a year every year since the year 2000, so I think that'll continue. It's definitely much more common in moms of advanced maternal age. And does everybody remember what that magic age is? 35, yeah, which to me is really not that old. So, lots of complications can occur both in mom and baby, and we'll talk about those as we go through the lecture. So. Okay, so again, some other classifications that you'll see on charts or hear talked about or may affect management of the patient. So we talk about gestational hypertension. That's really just mild hypertension after 20 weeks. They're not spilling any protein in their urine. They don't have any other related symptoms to it. Sometimes I've seen this managed just by having her cut back on her hours at work. Or, you know, we don't routinely tell people to decrease the salt in their diet anymore. But for pregnant women, sometimes that does help. So that may be something they need to try. Or maybe we're just going to have her start checking her blood pressure at home every day and keeping an eye on it. Now, when we talk about preeclampsia, that is when you have hypertension and protein in the urine after 20 weeks or even into the early postpartum, so that 4 to 6 weeks postpartum. Even though she's delivered her baby, we still would consider that preeclampsia. Some of the instances when it can occur more often is trophoblastic disease or a molar pregnancy. And I talked a little bit about a molar pregnancy, I think, last week. So a molar pregnancy is when you have a conception that occurs, normal development starts, but then it doesn't proceed. Or it does proceed, but it does not develop into a fetus. It's basically just a grape-like or a blob of cells. And that, of course, is not a viable pregnancy. Most often, those pregnancies, you've got to do a D&C, a dilation and curettage. And those patients need to be followed closely because that trophoblastic disease can become malignant. And I've seen a couple of those over the years. And what happens is it becomes, you know, it's trophoblastic, it's genetically altered cells. That's really what cancer cells are. And if it's truly malignant, then those women actually have to be treated with chemotherapy. That's always a hard one to explain to people because it starts out as this happy event of having a baby. And then suddenly, oh, no, you don't have a viable pregnancy. And, oh, by the way, you now need treatment for a malignancy. So you don't see a lot of those, but if you hear the term trophoblastic disease or molar pregnancy, that's what those are. The interesting thing, too, about preeclampsia is it's most often seen in a primipara. So, and again, women under the age of 19 or over the age of 40. And it can also occur in a multipara if she's got a new partner. And we'll talk more about that. And really what it is she's being exposed to some new proteins. So I'll tell you guys a joke, and if I offend anyone, I do apologize. But we used to say she's got a new mule kicking in her stall. You know, sometimes you got to tell a joke. You'll get crazy at work. All right. So eclampsia is all the components of preeclampsia, except it advances to the point that she's now having seizures and actually can go into a coma. Again, here in Billings, we don't see a lot of eclampsia, but it's always a possibility. And that's why we're so aggressive about monitoring these moms and staying on top of this condition. And again, with eclampsia, the seizures can occur before, during, or even after labor. So, women who are diagnosed with gestational hypertension before 35 weeks are the ones that are more likely to progress on to preeclampsia. And again, you'll see different judgment calls because, as I've said, it's not uncommon for pregnant women to sometimes spill a trace of protein in their urine because the thresholds get altered with pregnancy. They'll spill protein and sugar more easily. But if you see their blood pressure starting to creep up, and we don't routinely, you know, we used to have patients come in, man, they were dipping their urine all the time. Everybody came in with their paper bag. They brought their urine from home. We taught patients how to dip their urine. We don't do that so much anymore. But certainly anyone whose blood pressure is starting to creep up, it should be checked. And if she's got that protein, now it is a diagnosis. So again, gestational hypertension, a lot of this is just criteria to diagnose, but it is important to be able to understand it. So again, that's onset of hypertension, no protein in the urine after 20 weeks. And you all know this from med-surg, You want to take their blood pressure more than once. You know, you should never go by a single blood pressure reading. And in fact, we were told a few years ago, actually, was down, I won't say which hospital, but one of the hospitals, they were using one of the, you know, the blood pressures on the mobile cart, and just kept going by that reading and going by that reading. Looked like everything was going fine, and actually the cuff was not placed properly, the machine was not functioning properly, and the patient actually had a bad outcome. So again, if things don't seem to add up, you know, and that's what you're using, anytime you've got equipment or things don't seem right, never hesitate to double check with other equipment. It's amazing how, you know, and that's why we spend so much time when you first start out in nursing, you know, learning how to, you know, take a proper blood pressure, because I'm sure you've probably seen a lot of sloppy habits now with blood pressures being taken. So it is important. But again, you know, you want to get blood pressures greater than 140 over 90 on two separate occasions. Internal medicine about a year or two ago really lowered the limits for treatment of hypertension. And I think we're going to see the same kind of coming over into OB also. So, you know, again, it's any time after 20 weeks, but oftentimes it's those last few weeks of pregnancy when their blood pressure starts creeping up. And again, these are patients that had never had a problem with blood pressure before, and by about 6 weeks postpartum, it's resolved to normal. So that's great. But we are going to talk later in the lecture about some long-term issues related to this. So again, I differentiated, you know, mild preeclampsia versus severe preeclampsia. And it's important to look at those. And actually, severe preeclampsia is really the same thing as HELLP syndrome. And we're going to talk about that today, too. So really, those two have the same criteria. And that's often what you'll see is on a diagnosis is the patient has HELLP. In fact, some of you may know someone who had, you know, who's been pregnant, had some issues with their blood pressure, or perhaps even was diagnosed with actual HELLP syndrome. These are the patients that oftentimes on ultrasound, you're going to see them getting more frequent ultrasounds. We're very concerned about the growth of the baby because what do you know about the effect of hypertension on blood vessels? What does it do to those blood vessels? What are some of the complications related to having high blood pressure and not treating it?
Hypertrophic
cardiomegaly. Cardiomegaly, that's one. But what are some other? What's the one you really think about? If somebody walks in and they have a really, really high blood pressure, what's your most immediate concern as a nurse?
Stroke.
Stroke, yeah. Yeah. And why do they have those strokes? Yeah, it's usually damage to the lining of the vessels, maybe a clot, but usually, oftentimes it's damage to the lining of the vessels, and that's important to remember because what is the placenta but a big vascular organ? And so if you've got a patient with any type of hypertension, that's why you will see them being monitored more aggressively and more frequently. We're very concerned about is the blood flow to the placenta adequate to provide the oxygen, the nutrients, so this fetus can grow. And that's why oftentimes you'll see these babies are diagnosed on ultrasound as being IUGR, intrauterine growth restriction. Or oftentimes, again, these are the infants that are small for gestational age. Oftentimes when these women are laboring, these are the patients that you'll see in the charts, non-reassuring status on the monitor, and therefore they take them and, you know, get them delivered. So if it's mild, then usually we have pretty good outcomes and not a lot of complications for mom or baby. If we get into more severe or HELLP syndrome, not so much.
have the possibility of more complications.
So on D2L, I put some other supplements about pathophys of preeclampsia, and I would encourage you to take a look at them just to supplement, you know, what we're going to talk about in lecture today. But basically, in preeclampsia, we've got disruptions in placental perfusion and that damage to the lining of the endothelium. And that's important to remember. There's also some theories. Well, the big thing about preeclampsia and HELLP syndrome is we can't really predict always who's going to get it. And so that's what makes it difficult, you know, the prevention, treatment, all those things. And again, we'll talk more about who's more at risk. But there's also some theory that with endothelial cell dysfunction, damage to the lining, that there's actually some toxic substances released because of that damage. So what happens is you actually get vascular remodeling of the vessels, the uterine vessels supplying the uterine blood flow. So it affects the placenta, it's going to affect the blood flow to the uterus. And so what happens is you get decreased perfusion through the placenta and actual hypoxia of the infant. And so that's oftentimes where you'll see on ultrasound, there'll be comments about decreased fetal movements, or sometimes prior to delivery, women will come into the office and they will be placed on the fetal monitor, and we'll just watch them for like 20 minutes. That's a non-stress test. And sometimes those will not be as reactive as we would like. Or again, if she's in labor and you're monitoring her and we see that non-reassuring fetal status upon labor and delivery. So again, if you get this placental ischemia and our endothelial cell dysfunction, and then release of the toxic substances, then what happens is it leads to actually a generalized vasospasm. And I really, really want to emphasize that to you. That is the mechanism that's causing the problem with high blood pressure in pregnancy. Because, you know, a lot of times conditions happen where we have vasodilation, and our bodies, you know, as time goes on, we can often accommodate to that, or the same with vasoconstriction. Either way, oftentimes, you know, you'll see people, they're probably not in the best health, obviously, but they get along. Their bodies learn to accommodate. Perhaps we're, you know, supporting them with medications, and they do okay. But with vasospasm, we can't predict, because we can have dilation, we can have constriction. And that's the mechanism of problem in PIH. And so what happens is, with the vasospasm, you've got poor tissue perfusion. And that leads to an increase in the peripheral vascular resistance and elevated blood pressure. And then what the effect that has is that causes that interstitial fluid to leak out. Or it causes the fluid to leak out of the blood. Excuse me, I said that wrong. It causes the fluid, the plasma portion, to leak out of the blood vessels into the interstitial space. And so that's why these women often will present with increased swelling. Now that's a tricky one too, because we've talked about the normal symptoms of pregnancy. Easily, women can walk around with little puffy feet for 2-3 months. If it's summertime, it's hot, when I worked in the office, you could just about predict every year the week of the fair in Billings, everybody would be calling with swollen feet because they'd all gone to the fair, usually on the hottest day of the week, and had corn dogs and popcorn. You know, you could just about predict the scenario. But in these patients, oftentimes it's not just swelling in the lower extremities. They may start experiencing it in their hands or even their face. And those are the patients I used to get really, really concerned about. And I can tell you, when I was an OB nurse, working for an OB doc, if patients would call and say, you know, I woke up this morning and my feet are more swollen, and I've got this big headache, and I just don't feel quite right, I would always bring her in for a blood pressure check. And if it was fine, great. You know, sorry I wasted your time today. Go shopping or have coffee or go back to work or whatever. Get on with your life. But more than once, we caught somebody who was starting to have these vague symptoms. We checked their pressure. It was starting to go up. So I always, that was just my, what I always did. So here's all the risk factors for who can get this. And you can see there's a lot. First-time pregnancies, advanced maternal age, genetic tendency. That's why, you know, when we do that first prenatal visit, we want to try to get a good family history. You know, if a woman comes in and says, yeah, my sister or my mother, or my mother and my grandmother, you know, a lot of the women in my family have blood pressure problems. That puts me on alert. I want to be aware of that. As I said, diabetes, any type of diabetes, type 1, type 2, either of those. It's not uncommon to often see those go hand in hand. If it's a multiple gestation, so she's carrying more than one fetus, those women are at higher risk for PIH. Obesity, some underlying vascular disease. They may not even be aware that they have it. Antiphospholipid antibody syndrome. You don't see a lot of that, and that actually can be a cause for infertility. So I've not ever seen, that I can recall, a patient with that, but if they are pregnant, certainly this is going to put them at higher risk. Again, patients with underlying chronic hypertension, and then they can get a superimposed preeclampsia or gestational hypertension, renal disease. And so again, that's why ideally we would do that preconception counseling. And interestingly, like so many things now, our technology, our knowledge base, our medications has gotten so much better. And so oftentimes, you know, what you used to see even 10 years ago, or certainly 20 or more, women were maybe told, oh, you shouldn't have children. Now we're able to manage those pregnancies more successfully, and they're allowed to, you know, they're not discouraged from pregnancy. But it certainly requires more aggressive, not just medical, but also nursing management. Again, any history in a previous pregnancy. So again, that's why we want to know not just how many pregnancies you had, but what happened with each delivery. Because as you've seen, you know, each time can be a little bit different. Any connective tissue disorders, lupus, things like that. African Americans, and I'm also going to add to that, African Americans, Hispanic, and Native Americans can often all present with a higher risk. And again, new paternity. So again, my little joke about the new mule kicking in the stall. But really what it is it's a new combination. She's been exposed to new proteins or new substances, and that's often why that can be a problem. So it's no comment on the dad. I want to be clear about that. All right. So I'm going to repeat this in a bit. I think I went through this lecture yesterday and try to add some points, but really what we want to do is treat these women, any woman who's got a history of hypertension or has early onset, we now treat them with a baby aspirin, an 81 milligram a day baby aspirin. We start that late in the first trimester. Or any woman that's had a history in a prior pregnancy, we want to treat her with a baby aspirin. Now, normally we tell patients, you know, you shouldn't be taking a lot of medications in pregnancy. So, again, it sometimes it's good as the nurse to explain, well, in this instance, the benefits outweigh the risks. And, again, a low-dose baby aspirin probably is not going to cause a problem. It'll be interesting to see if this changes, however, because just in the last month, it's come out that, you know, they were a lot of older adults have been told to take baby aspirin to prevent heart disease, certain cancers, and some of the newer research is not backing that up so much anymore. And in fact, of course, in older adults, the concern with giving a daily baby aspirin is GI bleeds. So there's been some looks at, you know, should we give vitamin E, vitamin C? No benefit to that. Salt restriction, as I said, it's not routinely done, but there are some women that are more sensitive to salt, and it may help them. And frankly, probably we all are getting way too much salt in our diets anyway. You know, if you look at the food labels, yeah, we won't go there yet. Putting people on bed rest, women on bed rest early in pregnancy, has not been shown to have any benefit. And in fact, it probably is going to cause some more problems. I mean, you all know the risks of immobility. And again, pregnancy is a hyper-hormonal state. So you're more likely to develop blood clots just being pregnant anyway. So putting you on bed rest, if it's not beneficial, it's just not recommended. So as I said earlier, the cause is unknown. There's alterations in the placental perfusion. And again, I know I'm repeating this, but it causes placental hypoxemia. Okay. So literally that baby, it's kind of like, I always visualize it, it's like someone's grabbing that cord and kind of squeezing it. You know, or just think about, hopefully no one's ever had the experience of having something too tight around your neck or your airway feels restricted. That's how I picture it. And it also leads to acute atherosis. And so I even put the definition there. It's a maternal vascular lesion observed in cases of preeclampsia and idiopathic intrauterine growth restriction. Okay. So remember, if it's idiopathic, we don't know what's causing it. But when they look at, you know, sometimes some of you have probably been to a C-section and they took the placenta out, and did they... Anyone been in a section where they commented on the appearance of the placenta? Okay. Sometimes you'll hear, you know, they'll say, wow, this placenta doesn't look very good. There's lots of calcium deposits, or it was smaller than we expected. So you may, you know, see that sometimes in an op report, or they'll send it down to pathology, and that's when you find out some things. But yeah, it just doesn't look good. And in fact, you can have placental infarctions. And occasionally you'll see those comments too on a pathology report, that there was areas of infarct noted in the placenta. So again, think about it. You know, we think about heart attacks, it's a myocardial infarction. Well, you can have a placental infarction. And oftentimes it's thought that this endothelial cell on the maternal side, the dysfunction is probably due to some sort of oxidative stress and genetic factors. And, you know, this is a bit outside this lecture, but there's a lot of attention being paid to trying to protect your DNA and prevent damage. So, you know, hopefully later in life you'll deal with you know, ideally less cancers and less diseases. But oxidative stress. So again, things like smoking. Another reason we don't want women smoking in pregnancy. Too much sunlight. There's a whole lot, you know, going on about food and our food sources. I just saw an article that came out last week that has, you know, again, it's one study, needs to be replicated, but talked about eating organic produce probably does reduce one's incidence of developing cancer by 20%. Because that's often been the concern, is that you know, you eat all this, but you don't really know what you're getting in your food source. So, I don't know. We'll see where the research goes.
So, Teresa, I'm sure that is supposed to say restriction, but it's not retardation, is it?
That, yeah. Okay. I apologize. That's actually an old term. We used to call it intrauterine growth retardation. Now we use restriction.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. So thank you for clarifying that. But you'll still hear somebody. Sometimes that's the term that's used, but that they mean the same thing.
Okay.
It's just the term retardation. Yeah, I'm not really sure what all led to us changing the term. So preeclampsia, as I said, it's a new onset of protein in the urine with an increase in blood pressure. We'll talk about HELLP syndrome, and actually these are components of HELLP syndrome. So let's page through this. Okay. So part of identifying patients who are going to have complications with their blood pressure or, you know, less than favorable outcomes, we want to educate those patients well, and that always goes back not just to the nurse, but a lot of it does fall back to the nurse. This just happens to be a brochure that I found that was written to give to patients because, again, just like I said, sometimes I'd have patients call me up and say, you know, I'm just not feeling great. I can't put my finger on anything, but I know that I should call and report any symptoms. So that's why it's really important for nurses to establish that trust with their patients and be able to, you know, have the patient call and feel comfortable calling. I think that's the other thing is, sometimes patients, they'll often say, oh, I didn't want to bother you, or, oh, I'm sorry to bother you, and it's like, no, please bother me, that's what I'm paid for, that's why I'm here, I am here, so I want you to bother me. But anyway, that's just an example of a nice piece of literature that I found for patients. So when we talk about actual HELLP syndrome, get out of the way, it is a multi-system disorder, okay? So one of the things you may see is oliguria, and it's because the perfusion to the kidneys is decreased. And on their labs, you may see a decrease in the GFR, and that can actually lead to changes in the glomeruli. And so their uric acid may be elevated. Again, you'll see albumin decreasing as the plasma colloid osmotic pressure decreases. So again, that's why fluid moves out of the vessels and out into the interstitial spaces. But because of that, they also now have hemoconcentration. And when you've got that, again, remember, pregnancy is a hyperhormonal state, and so they are more likely to develop blood clots with pregnancy itself, and now we've added another risk factor. Okay. So these are the patients that actually, instead of seeing, you know, normally we anticipate during pregnancy that their hematocrit may decrease. You know, I'm sure a lot of you have taken care of patients that they came in for that 28-week glucose and they had their hematocrit checked and they were advised to start taking extra iron because they were anemic. That's actually expected and oftentimes considered a normal event of pregnancy. But in these patients, because they're getting hemoconcentrated, the hematocrit may actually go up. So it's not always a good thing. So again, vasospasm in the arterial side. And that also leads to damage in the lining of the endothelium. And these patients are more predisposed to developing pulmonary edema. They also will have decreased perfusion to the liver. And so that's oftentimes where they'll develop that epigastric pain or that right upper quadrant pain. Now, has anyone been with your nurse in clinical and they were, you know, assessing the patient, you know, anyone that had a patient with high blood pressure? Were they assessing that and looking at that? Your patient, Laura?
Yeah.
And did they have any complaints of epigastric pain or that vague nausea?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So we want to pay attention to that. If oftentimes you'll see with these patients, they may be ordering chem screens every so often or checking liver function tests. And a normal it's an abnormal finding, but in HELP, those LFTs will be elevated. The problem with this is they actually can develop hepatic edema, and in extreme cases, you can have a hepatic rupture occur. I mean, that's rare, but it's the end result and the worst case scenario. At that point, it's life-threatening, and mom may not survive. I've never seen that happen, but it's something we want to be aware of.
So, Teresa, these are like symptoms of HELP? Is
this what we're talking about? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, let's just finish this slide, and then I'll give you guys a quick break.
Okay.
So, in HELP syndrome, you'll also have complications neurologically. And it can be kind of this slippery slope of they go from just mild hypertension, preeclampsia, but then they can develop these related symptoms and get into HELP syndrome. And so this is when, the neural complications, they'll often present with a headache, or they'll complain of visual disturbances, or they're seeing spots before their eyes. And they can be hyperreflexive. That's why we check them for ankle clonus. So again, with all of this, you'll have decreased placental perfusion. IUGR can result. Placental abruptions. So that's where the placenta, as you remember, separates early from the wall of the uterus. Sometimes these patients, again, during pregnancy, they'll have those mild placental infarcts just during pregnancy, and then at delivery, as I said, when they look at the placenta, they'll note that it didn't look as healthy or there was areas of necrosis or infarction. These are sometimes also the pregnancies where they'll comment that there was early degeneration of the placenta, you know, because it's kind of like a carton of milk, you know, it has an expiration date, and that's why we don't like women to go too far over their due date, and most women by 40 weeks, they are ready to deliver, but certainly if you ever see someone that goes 41, 42 plus weeks, their placenta may appear as if it's aging early, so it's starting to degenerate. But in someone with HELP, it can actually occur earlier. We'll talk a little bit about the fetal complications related to the disease in mom. But let's take a stretch break, because I see people sort of getting that 3 o'clock slump, and I don't know if you guys have been affected by the time change, but
so I went through fast, and I just saw a few of the same slides and said, oh, it's okay.
So is that more that 3 to 4 pages, that's both your part, you and your partner, right?
Yeah, they're total.
Okay, total.
And then not including the title. Which I never count them so
easily. I know, I never count that. So technically, like, page and a half for you, and a page and a half for your partner.
If that's how you break it up.
Yeah.
But
technically, right? Is that 3 or 4 pages is between you and your partner?
The presentation applies to what's
coming. Oh, man.
Because your presentation is based off the paper, so you just have to write it. Basically, the
paper is that PowerPoint's not going
And the fact that we have like between 5 to 10 minutes to present, like, it's going to be so fast. By the time you get up there, you get all your stuff going, you start talking a little bit, and we're done. So, it's just actually like getting all of the information and
everything. Mine is just really sad. Mine is human centered.
Yours is?
Yeah.
Mine's oral health across the women's lives.
I wish I could have my friend be I wonder if we can do like a guest speaker. Because I know a friend of mine. Friend of mine's mom is dealing with sex trafficking. That'd be so cool.
Yeah, or except you only have like 5 minutes to present.
Yeah.
But that'd be, I mean, you could ask her one of her times.
I mean, well, probably can't anyway. She's in the business.
Oh, yeah. That's so sad.
Oh, it's terrible.
Yeah. It's so sad that there's so much going on about TV. It's actually really sweet.
I don't even know what articles. It's just so much out there, you know. I think.
I'm just confused with all the articles, like, across the board.
Oral care, right, for you?
Yep. There's
just going to be a lot.
I know. So a paper's going to be so broad, it's going to cover all three of those. So I'm like, I'll think about before birth and during pregnancy, or before,
and then you all have like little. I think that should, yeah. I mean, it is a thing.
I know, that's why I'm like, across the lifespan, like, this is way too much.
No. Who's your partner now?
Price.
That would be pretty easy. people keep like mixing you and
me. Let's get going and then,
semester, but
you know, because nobody ever complains to me if I end class early. No, I know. I try to be. All right. So, I know it's hard to see, but just to see in here what, so to differentiate out, you know, so gestational hypertension, we usually think of that as just elevated blood pressure, but and there's no protein in the urine, okay? So they've just got a mild elevation in their blood pressure, all right? And that excludes women with chronic hypertension. So chronic hypertension is when you got it before pregnancy or you develop it before 20 weeks, right? Then preeclampsia, if mild, is when we have an elevated blood pressure and now they're spilling some protein in their urine. Severe preeclampsia has the same features, but now severe preeclampsia or eclampsia are the same thing. That's the problem. We don't stick with the same nomenclature. So really, severe preeclampsia or eclampsia, sorry, this pen it's kind of losing its own. That's the moms that can have seizures or even go into coma. And then there's HELLP syndrome, and I apologize, I got myself out of order. So let's talk about HELLP syndrome. Because what HELLP syndrome is, it's a lab diagnosis, and it's a variant of severe preeclampsia or eclampsia. So what HELLP stands for, and I put it in red, so you'll see hemolysis of the red blood cells, elevated liver enzymes, and low platelets. So really, HELLP syndrome is a lab diagnosis. Again, they'll still have elevated blood pressure, they'll be spilling protein in their urine. And again, these are the patients that are at much higher risk for developing seizures. So if we've got a patient with HELLP syndrome, we want to be doing some aggressive management with her, monitoring and management. So again, the main mechanism is vasospasm. We really want to stress that. And that leads to a lot of the symptoms throughout her body that we see. So you have vasospasm, again, endothelial cell dysfunction that can actually leave those fibrin deposits. And of course, you know that those can either decrease blood flow or they can break off and become an embolus. Okay. Yes?
I just want to make sure I have it clear in my head. So like severe preeclampsia is basically...
Yes,
okay.
But you'll see both terms used.
Okay.
That's why I said we don't agree. We can't agree on what name we should use, but really if you see the term severe, just think we've now advanced to eclampsia.
I guess like during clinical, when I was talking, had that conversation with a bunch of doctors and nurses about it, they were saying like they break it up preeclampsia to mild severe, and then they said they basically just like... retrospectively label it severe if it leads to eclampsia and they have seizures. So like they say like their preeclampsia became severe enough to develop into eclampsia.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, we don't all use the same nomenclature.
Okay.
But yeah, severe preeclampsia, certainly she's at higher risk for having seizures. And that's, so again, think about what do you do if you've got a patient who you're concerned that your patient's going to have seizures. Put them on seizure precautions, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, maybe move them closer to the nurse's station. you know, pad the bed rails, you know, more frequent monitoring of the patient, all those things. But HELP syndrome, again, so the acronym is there. Again, it's the vasospasm, and again, we see hemolysis. It should be RBCs, not RBS. I left out the C. So hemolysis of the red blood cells, and so you'll see a decrease in their red count. But also their platelets go down, and that's when we get concerned, because of course our platelets are essential for clotting in a normal range. We don't want her to clot, but we don't want her to bleed either. And that's oftentimes why the preferable method for getting these patients delivered is a vag delivery. And by the way, the only cure for eclampsia, well, for preeclampsia and eclampsia and HELP syndrome is delivery. But it can be a bit of a waiting game. We don't want to get her delivered too early and deal with a premature infant. So oftentimes what we want to do is try to keep her pregnant as long as possible, as long as mom is stable, and baby seems to be doing okay. But again, that's why we do more frequent monitoring of these patients, because, you know, sometimes it's a day-by-day decision, or perhaps hour by hour, that if things are not going well, then it's time to get them delivered. But as I said, preferably it will be a vaginal delivery rather than a C-section. But you will also see oftentimes C-sections are scheduled and just done because we've got to get her delivered. So again, you'll see increase in liver function test. But oftentimes these patients again will present with kind of those non-specific symptoms, you know, a vague headache, or they just don't feel good. They'll you know, they wake up one day and, you know, that just that malaise, that maybe you're coming down with something, you're not sure. Again, they may complain of epigastric or right upper quadrant pain, possibly a return of nausea and vomiting that they hadn't had since first trimester. Headaches, visual disturbances, or they may complain that they're starting to have more bruising than they used to, or possibly even spilling some blood in their urine. And again, that's a tricky one, because is it a UTI? Has she had intercourse recently? A lot of times women who are pregnant, if they have intercourse, they can have some postcoital spotting, and it's not of consequence. But again, a lot of times you've really got to put all the pieces of this puzzle together. So as I said, they may present with these symptoms, but then the appropriate lab, you know, we do an assessment, and that includes getting a full chem screen, chem panel, to see what's going on with their labs. Some of the complications, as I said, these patients can be at higher risk for pulmonary edema, adult respiratory failure, DIC. So DIC is disseminated intravascular clotting. And you will hear that when you're in the ICU. So that's coming up next semester. Basically, DIC is, it's never a disease. DIC doesn't just happen. So I want to emphasize that. It's a result of a previous event. So that's why oftentimes you'll see it in ICU patients. They've had, you know, a massive MI or massive trauma or something else. And what happens is their clotting mechanism gets basically messed up, and they can be clotting, but they can be bleeding the same time. So these patients can be a real challenge to manage. Usually if someone gets DIC, I mean, way back in the dark ages was when I was an ICU nurse, if your patient got DIC, you figured they were probably not going to survive. And I think, obviously, still, the mortality rate is quite high. So it's a challenge to manage them because you may have to transfuse them, but anticoagulate them. And these are very, very sick patients. So that's why you see them in the ICU. Fortunately, we don't see a lot of it, but it can happen with a really sick mom who has HELLP syndrome. Again, placental abruption. So again, that premature separation of the placenta from the uterine wall. It can be partial, it can be complete. Remember, if someone comes in bleeding and she's got a placental abruption, our only option is to get her delivered. So the cat's out of the bag, as we say. It's time to get her delivered. If it's a small partial abruption, sometimes those will seal over and she'll go on to, you know, continue her pregnancy. But for the most part, most abruptions, it's time to get that baby delivered. They can have liver hemorrhage or failure, sepsis or stroke. So again, patients with HELLP, you need close monitoring and good management. A mom who's diagnosed with HELLP, the rate of premature delivery is about 70%. So again, as I said, sometimes you'll see patients hospitalized with, you know, HELLP syndrome or, you know, severe preeclampsia, and, you know, we're trying to get them, sometimes if we can just get them another week along in that pregnancy, that's preferable. So, perinatal or the infant mortality can be anywhere from about 7 to 20%. Interestingly, for moms, it's about 1%. However, I have seen pregnant women have a stroke. And, you know, that's obviously when someone envisions going in to have a baby, that's not what they envision, is they're going to have a stroke and possibly have to stay longer or be disabled because of it. Let's see. Alright, so this is my attempt at being artistic. Now you know why I'm not an art teacher. But I just, at the time I drew this, it made a whole lot more sense. But if you have retinal artery spasm, you're going to have headaches, right? And it's going to affect your vision. If you have cerebral artery spasm, you're going to have CNS symptoms. So those headaches, that vision, some of you probably get migraine headaches and you get those visual aura. Anybody know what I'm talking about? They can be, yeah, you may lose part of your vision, or you have this, like, see the weird spinning lights. Yeah, I happen to be one of them, so I know what the spinning lights are all about. And if it affects the GI system, you're going to have that epigastric pain. So again, yeah, I'll probably remove this slide, but at the time I did it, I just got in my computer and I thought it was just really, I made a lot of sense. But anyway, you can ignore my hard work. All right, so let's talk about nursing care. I've already alluded to some of this. Obviously, you get that careful, detailed history on patients, because that in itself can predict what type of management, who's at risk, what should we be doing for this patient to ensure a healthy outcome. So again, medical history, family history, pregnancy, social history. By the way, patients who use, you know, methamphetamine, cocaine, you know, any of those kind of drugs, they're definitely at higher risk for developing hypertension during pregnancy. And so again, as a nurse, it's really important. I learned this a few years ago. Instead of saying, you know, to a patient, you know, do you smoke grass? Or do you do whatever? I don't know. See, I'm old. That was the lingo. Whatever. you know, it's better to just say, does anyone in your household use drugs that are not prescribed? You know, make it a general question. And oftentimes, then it's easier for the patient to start talking about what's going on. Because really, I don't want patients to see me as the nurse that I'm judging them. If anything, I want them to see me as I want to help the outcome for their baby. So I just think, when I read that, I thought, you know, that really is true. Because for so long, we've asked patients, you know, how many drinks do you have in a day? You know, and most people don't tell the truth, I can tell you that. The joke is kind of, they tell you, whatever number they tell you, you should double it. But you know, getting a good history, you know, what's going on. And again, we're paying a lot more attention to as to what's going on in their environment, you know, the whole notion of, you know, social situation and the effects of, you know, poverty, homelessness. We've had homeless women come in now and have babies. Melissa Jennings just completed her defense and she did it on human trafficking. And we've had some patients here that the nurses are, you know, we're really starting to ramp up how can nurses identify that, because they've had two or three patients now that came in to deliver and they really thought that they probably were human trafficked. So I think, you know, that's going to be another challenge for all of you as you get out into practice. But, you know, again, on those regular prenatal visits, obviously we check their blood pressure every time. And maybe we want her to be checking it in between times. You know, and bringing in her cart. You know, assessing for edema. Is it more? Is it increasing? You know, certainly you'll be looking at this is in a hospital patient now. We're going to be looking at DTRs, uterine tone and tenderness. Sometimes these women come in and they're having a lot of preterm labor symptoms, or they may even complain of some uterine tenderness. And then our challenge is it because they're having contractions, or do they have a early chorioamnion that's going on? So again, I always think of OB patients. They're like this big puzzle. You got to figure out how to put all the pieces together so we come up with a good diagnosis and a good treatment for her. Any vaginal bleeding. And again, not all vaginal bleeding in pregnancy is bad. Certainly no one likes to see it. It can be very alarming for patients. But again, maybe it's related to a recent episode of intercourse. Maybe she was really super constipated. You know, we nurses, we love to talk about the bowels. Did you guys know that? That's why we're always asking patients. But no, truly. You know, OB patients, if they get really constipated and they're really straining, that actually can cause some vaginal spotting. So I always like to think of it as, let's start out with a simple fix and let's hope it's a simple cause and go to the more complex. Again, we talked about labs, so CBC or liver function tests or a liver panel. These patients may also, you may be doing a 24-hour urine on them. And if you've ever had to instruct patients, they always love it because they go to the lab and the lab hands them a big jug. And literally for the next 24 hours, every drop of urine that comes out of their body has to go in that jug. If it does not, the test is not valid. The patient has to start all over again. So again, it's really important that if you're the nurse instructing the patient, really emphasize that point, because I had to tell someone more than once because they'd say, oh, I brought my urine back and I forgot after lunch and I flushed it. It's like, oh, sorry, you're going to start over. So it really is important. And or we may just be doing, you know, dipsticks on their urine, checking for protein. Daily kick counts, that's one of the most easiest, cheapest medical tests out there, because all we have her do is, if she's non-hospitalized, we just have her lay down for an hour a day, usually pick a time. Most women, you know, latter part of pregnancy, they can kind of identify a pattern with their baby of when it's active. We ask them to choose that time. Lay down for an hour, not on their back, of course, because we don't want to compress the vessels, and count the number of movements they feel within an hour. The kind of general guideline is if it's 10 or more, that's great. No matter how slight those movements are, as long as they're feeling them. If it's less than 10, then they should call their doctor's office. And that is, it's simple, it can be done at home, but it actually can be quite reliable. And again, if you're ever working in OB or you're working in the ER, which I know a lot of people are interested in doing that, and you get the phone call that you might get, it doesn't seem like my baby's as active today, or I haven't felt the baby move, bring that patient in immediately. And hopefully, if there's something adverse going on, catch it. Because we're going to talk in a couple weeks. The next class is going to be the perinatal loss and grief panel. And you're going to hear some of those stories of moms who lost their baby either during labor, delivery, or prior to it, and had no inkling. So it really is important to have them do that. Non-stress test, again, easy, can be done in an outpatient setting. You just put them on the monitor and watch how many contractions are they having, because oftentimes women are having contractions but they're not feeling them prior to delivery. How many are they having, and how's the baby responding? And a biophysical profile. Again, that specialized ultrasound exam. Bed rest may be prescribed. Now, there's a lot of controversy going on. As I said, we don't put women on bed rest to prevent it. Once they're diagnosed, they may be instructed to cut back on their activity or lay down for an hour every afternoon, or perhaps they may be placed on full bed rest. But as I said, that comes with risks too, so you've got to weigh risks versus benefits. There has been some correlation that found that women with low vitamin D levels may be at higher risk for preeclampsia and HELLP syndrome. So again, we all know that we probably, most of us living where we do, don't have adequate vitamin D levels. If you haven't had yours checked, I would encourage you to do so. The problem, of course, again, with the whole vitamin D is we can't agree on how much supplementation we should recommend. You know, the actual levels that I've seen is like 800 IUs a day. Well, if you go to the pharmacy or Target or Walmart or wherever and you're going to buy vitamin D supplements, most of them are like 2,500 or 4,000 IUs a tablet. For most of us, we can tolerate that. Pregnant women, you know, their OB needs to decide how much does he want to take. Should the patient be taking? Again, regular diet and fluid intake. Yeah, maybe, I don't know that we need to put these patients on a huge salt restriction, but as I said earlier, it may help some women. And again, that's a whole other talk in itself. You know, next time you go to the grocery store, you know, the best place to shop in the grocery store is, you know, the outer edges. That's where the healthy food is. Because it's where the produce and the dairy and the meat are. So all the stuff in the middle that's in boxes and cans, probably not so good for us. Well, it isn't. But, you know, just take a look at some labels. It is amazing the amount of salt. So I always joke about this. My husband loves to go to Costco. Like, that's his, you know, like, let's go to Costco for lunch, you know. Loves all the samples. And you taste things and you think, oh, isn't this great? And then, of course, he'd bring me along and I'd pick up the label and say, no, we're not buying this. Put it back. No, can't buy that. Thank you. So, but it is amazing the amount of salt that we don't even perceive as salt taste. So it is important to read labels. roughage, again, very, very important. As I say, it's our friend fiber. And then again, early prenatal care is so important that we can identify who's at risk and hopefully, if not totally prevent it, at least decrease the severity or identify patients that are progressing to a point where they may not have good outcomes in the pregnancy and get them delivered. You know, if she's less than 34 weeks, ideally we'd like to keep her pregnant for a longer period of time. Again, every week that we can get her closer to full term, all the better outcome for baby. You know, a stay in the NICU, it doesn't take very long till it adds up to about $1 million. And unfortunately, you know, I know when I went into nursing, I didn't want to think about the dollars and cents side of healthcare. But it is a reality, and I do think about patients when they have to go home after these prolonged hospitalizations. They're dealing with the stress of that, but then I can tell you they're going to start getting the calls too about the bills. So again, if we can keep her pregnant, all the better. The other thing too about these patients is identifying who's really at high risk, maybe who shouldn't deliver here, or who shouldn't deliver out in the little small rural hospitals of our state or many states, who should be transferred to a high-risk pregnancy center for better management. And it is much easier to transport a mom with the baby in utero as opposed to transporting mom and a premature baby. So these are the patients too. We want to identify them early. And another reason is we'd like to get some betamethasone on board. As I said, every week we get her closer to term, all the better. But the odds are she probably won't go to full term. But we'd like her to get those two doses of betamethasone to enhance fetal lung maturity. And she may be given betamethasone, dexamethasone. I think either one will work fine. What we see here at St. V's is they get two doses of betamethasone about 24 hours apart. Ideally, you get both of those on board. And the effect of that, it'll start 24 hours after it's given, lasts for up to 7 days. And that's great. If we go another 7 days, that's another week of maturity for that baby. Now, as I said, ideally, we do a vag delivery and not a C-section, but if you see fetal distress, well, you gotta get that baby delivered. Placental abruption, HELLP syndrome that is getting worse, oliguria, which is less than 20 cc's an hour, urine production, we need to get her delivered. Again, pulmonary edema, or blood pressure we can't control with medications. I will tell you, even to this day, if I see a patient up on that unit that's running blood pressures, you know, we had one, I think this semester recently, you know, was running like 180 over 110. It's like, that makes me so nervous. I'm just so concerned about those patients. Or if she's getting to 37, 38 weeks, usually it's just time to get them delivered. Things are not going to improve, and she's close enough to term that now the benefits of delivery outweigh the risks of keeping her pregnant.
Teresa?
Yeah.
Would they do induction, or would they go straight for C-section?
Well, again, it's going to depend on all these little things, like what's going on with her blood pressure. Are we giving her meds and it's bringing it down? Does she have other symptoms? What's the comfort level of the provider? She's probably had a NICU consult. What's going on ultrasound with the baby? So there's just a lot of factors that come into play. Ideally, it would be a vag delivery, but I'm going to say that, honestly, my observation is more often than not, they're just taking it for a section. Yeah. Yeah, they just got to get them delivered. Because oftentimes, I think what happens too is they bring them in for an induction, and then things are clicking along, and then all of a sudden, babe gets into distress, and they've just got to get her delivered. So again, those are those code one crash C-sections where, you know, everybody goes flying back to the OR, and they have that baby delivered in about 5 or 6 minutes. So, but you know, there's the ideal, what we would like, but then there's the real world. If it's, you know, if you're not going to get her delivered, again, she may be admitted, put on bed rest or restricted activity. Sometimes you'll see that where they're up on labor and delivery, and maybe they're allowed to be out of bed for 2 hours a day, something like that. Certainly seizure precautions, we talked about that. And again, every patient you ever take care of in the hospital, you should always have O2 and suction available. Interestingly, I just went to I went to Sim Camp on Friday in Bozeman, and there's a company up there. Actually, it's been a great job. I've decided in the future. If you really love simulation, they've got a whole company now. They got this huge sim bus. Like, they drive around and do simulations everywhere. But they talked about they visited. They didn't tell us where, but it was a smaller hospital in the state to do some training. And in the process of doing the training, I think they discovered that like every O2 connector was bad. So if they'd really gotten into an emergency situation, they wouldn't have known it until, you know, they had a bad outcome. So I guess it speaks to, you know, I think sometimes a lot of you probably have jobs where, you know, you have to stock rooms at work, or you got to go do, you know, those mundane tasks. And it's easy to get complacent about them, but boy, when you get into an emergency situation, you'll be real glad that somebody checked that. So that's my pitch for safety and prevention. Oftentimes they may, well, I can't say how often, they may be on a fluid restriction of 125 cc's an hour. And oftentimes that's combined oral and IV, and so that often gets into a bit of a challenge. Not an OB, but I have had med-surg patients that were on severe restrictions and were like trying to crawl out of bed and sneak a drink when the nurse wasn't looking. And nursing is never boring, I will say that. All right, so let's talk about some of the drugs we use. So mag sulfate, anybody take care of any patients this semester that were on mag or had been on mag? So, you know, really it's the drug of choice to prevent or treat seizure activity. All right. Now, if MAG doesn't control the seizures fully, they may add some other drugs like Ativan, Valium, but oftentimes all you're going to see is MAG. Now, the thing about MAG is very, very potent. These patients are in our setting. They're over on labor and delivery. MAG has to be given on an IV pump. Okay, it should never be given otherwise. And by the way, it absolutely should never be given IM. All right. Typical orders, you'll see that they should get a loading dose, and then you have your maintenance dose. And so MAG is one of those meds, again, that often two nurses will check it to be sure that the dosing is correct, that the concentration is correct, the rate is correct. And I just really want to emphasize to all of you, never feel like you can't check drug doses with another nurse. Even if you've given it before, I have seen mistakes made with IV medications, and I have seen a patient die as a result of one, an error made by a nurse. So I just really want to encourage you to do that. I think especially now where we have so much coming at us all day long, and there's a phone, and there's a Vocera, and there's this, and there's that. So never feel like you can't do that. Now, they may have
It does cause smooth muscle relaxation, and so it may take their blood pressure too low. And that's why sometimes they'll back off on the mag or turn it off altogether. As I said, it should never be given IM. You can't control the absorption rate. Once it's in, you can't take it back. That's the great thing about IV meds. If you're having some adverse effects, you can just shut it off. But IM, no. Also, it can cause tissue necrosis. So the action of MAG is it interferes with the release of acetylcholine at the synapses, and therefore it decreases the neuromuscular irritability, and it will depress cardiac conduction, but it also decreases the CNS irritability. That's why it works to prevent seizures. But MAG is excreted in the urine, so you want to keep really accurate INO on these patients. Occasionally you'll see, levels ordered of their serum MAG levels. And if it gets too high, they're considered MAG toxic. And again, you just decrease. Sometimes when patients are on MAG, oftentimes they don't like how it makes them feel. They'll feel warm or flushed or sweaty, burning at the IV site. So again, you want to do a careful assessment of your IV site and make sure it's not getting infiltrated, because we don't want to infuse MAG. We don't want to infuse any medication into an infiltrated IV. So again, if they have mild toxicity, what you'll often see is they just start getting more lethargic, kind of sleepy. They may complain of feeling weak. Their DTRs, their reflexes may start getting, more decreased in response. Their speech is slurred. However, if you start seeing hypotension, bradycardia, hopefully it will never progress so far that you have full cardiac arrest, but if you don't turn it off, that's a possibility. Calcium gluconate or calcium chloride is the antidote for too much MAG, and it should always be immediately available. So you don't want to have to be calling pharmacy at 3 a.m. and hoping they'll send it up real quick in the tube system. It should always be available. We talk a lot. I think nursing, we've always, a lot of things we do in terms of good patient care and being safe. But now we have, just more recognition of the importance of safety. So we really want to have that available. Interestingly, MAG does not affect babies. It's actually safe for them, and it's actually thought that it may provide a protective effect against cerebral palsy in those very low birth weight preemies. So those little 1 pound, 1.5 pound, those early, early preemies, MAG may actually be a benefit to them while they're in utero. Okay, so here's the indications for delivery. I don't know that I need to read all of that to you, because that would be, I would start getting the nods. But as I said, vag delivery is the preferred method. But again, you've got to look at everything that's going on and do the best you can. We try to avoid NSAIDs in hypertensive women, because we know that NSAIDs, well, a couple things, they can increase bleeding times, but also prolonged use of NSAIDs can have some adverse effects on the heart. So we try to stay away from those. But again, remember that preeclampsia, eclampsia, help. We don't usually think of it so much with help. can develop up to 6 weeks postpartum. So again, good discharge teaching for our patients. You know, we don't just say, oh, you've had your baby, go home and breastfeed every 2 hours, and oh, call us if you're bleeding, and you know, if you feel blue, well, it'll get better. No, we really want her to be aware of those emergent symptoms. And that's why we tell them, you know, if you develop shortness of breath, pain in your chest, pain in your calf, ideally we should be telling patients this. And that's why if I do discharge teaching, I always like to look a little bit at their prenatal records and see, again, what was their history? You know, did they have a history in a prior pregnancy? Do they have a family history of hypertension? Other drugs that you'll see, you know, if we're not worried about seizures, but we're just really worried about, you know, we want to treat that blood pressure, usually labetalol is what most commonly I've seen ordered. Hydralazine can also be ordered. Nifedipine, not so much, but nifedipine is a calcium channel blocker, and it actually can sometimes be used to treat preterm labor. If she hasn't delivered, of course, we're going to continue all our assessments. One thing to be aware of is if these patients come in to deliver, they can be at higher risk for postpartum hemorrhage. So again, you want to have things available for that. You want to be alert to that. Again, eclampsia, you know, we talked about seizure precautions, so I feel like I am repeating myself. Premature birth, we want to support the parents. But again, you oftentimes, you'll see these patients admitted, and that's the patient who has a NICU consult done to prepare them for, this is what NICU is, this is what we will be doing to support your baby. Oftentimes, they'll even take the parents down to NICU to see it. Because, and you'll see this even in adults in ICU, don't be surprised if families come in and the minute they see their loved one not looking like they thought and all the tubes and wires and beeping, I've seen more than one person pass out. So you know, the more we can prepare our patients, I always joke, and you know, my husband would tell you this too, like I'm the prepare for the worst scenario ever. Like I get on the airplane, I still, when they say look for the nearest exit, I still look for it, you know? I really do. You know, if that plane goes down, I want that in my head because I'm getting out of there, hopefully. And if it does go down, I hope it's on my way home from vacation and not on my way home, baby. That's my advice. So, prepare for the worst, hope for the best. But anyway, however, patients that have this have a 7 times increased risk in future pregnancies. And that's why we get so concerned about who had it, and what happened, how was it managed. Again, you'll always hear me talk about, let's try to talk about lifestyle changes. You know, ideally, again, it would be that preconceptual counseling, but that may not happen. Okay, so just a couple things. Back in 2014, the American Heart Association came out with a recommendation, and you are seeing this happen, but now maybe this will change because nothing stays the same in today's world. But at that time, any woman with a history of chronic hypertension or a history of PIH, the recommendation was that's someone who should be on a daily baby aspirin. Now again, as I said, recent study came out said maybe not. Yes.
I was just going to bring up that recent study and whether or not that's conclusive, because it was brought up in our research classes, and
yeah,
it was conclusive, and we're not doing that anymore.
Yeah. And so again, who knows?
Okay.
That could change by the time you graduate next year. It could change, but that is something we've been telling patients right now. But what I can say is any woman who has PIH
precursor that probably later in life she's going to be at risk for some sort of cardiovascular issue. So again, that's the patient we can identify and say, let's talk about lifestyle changes. You know, if this is someone who doesn't exercise, you know, maybe they hate going to the gym. Honestly, I can tell you, it's not my favorite thing to do, but to me, I figure every hour I get my sorry self down to that gym, it's another hour in my life bank, as I think of it. So it works for me. It gets me there, I can say. But we also, there's been some recommendation about having women take a calcium supplement, that may be helpful. Also, I really want to emphasize this, and this really doesn't apply so much to pregnancy, but any woman who's had hypertension should be carefully evaluated as to whether she should be using hormonal forms of birth control, because those can make her blood pressure be elevated. So that's why oftentimes women that are started on birth control pills should come in for a blood pressure check. Now, the great thing is we've got a lot more forms of delivering hormonal forms of birth control, some of them via IUD, and that's more a localized effect, not the systemic effect. But it's just something to keep in mind. If someone's had a history of high blood pressure, hormonal forms of especially oral birth control pills may not be the best method. And I also can tell you this. Any woman who's older than 35 and smokes absolutely, positively, 100% should never take birth control pills. That puts them at such a high risk of a stroke. So, again, that's another little carrot to try to get them to quit smoking. And then the last thing, again, I want to emphasize is the primary mechanism in PIH is vasospasm. So, if you can remember that, it makes it easier to begin to remember what are those systemic effects. Should we take about 10 minutes and go through multiple pregnancies?
I thought about it, and then I just turned it off.
Wait.
Because it started off with 7 minutes, or 7 hours, and now it's down to 5 hours. I think it's the battery life, or like how long it takes.
Do you feel comfortable just doing that on your own?
Yeah, I mean, it really will not take long. Let me just
pull that one up real quick.
Let's just record again. What are we going over?
Multiple pregnancy.
Okay, Brett, I'm going to have to return the thingy back on now.
Rachel.
What's up?
Genetic component. Interestingly, it's most common in African American people, at least common in Caucasian. And of course, these can be twins of two genders. So you can have male, female, or two male, two female, okay? This is more likely to increase with age. So again, advanced maternal age, increasing numbers of pregnancies, and the use of fertility drugs. So either the oral or injectable fertility drugs can all cause multiple pregnancies. So not just twins, but triplets, et cetera. We don't see as many higher order pregnancies, those four, five, sixes, as a result of infertility treatment like we used to. And I'll talk about that in a few weeks in, when we talk about infertility. So monozygotic or identical twins, that's where you have one fertilized ovum which divides. So it begins the process of dividing into a fetus, but then splits into two fetuses. Okay? So these will always be the same sex and the same genotype. In the process of dividing, if it occurs late in the process, that's when you can have conjoined twins. So, you know, every so often you hear about these surgeries where, you know, the babies are, you know, fused at the chest or the back, and it's a very long, involved surgery. In fact, I'm sure, but how many in here like Grey's Anatomy? Yeah, there was an episode on Grey's Anatomy, I think, when they were doing some big, big surgery. And this occurs in about roughly 1 out of 250 births. So that's just a quick overview of the difference between twins. So again, so multi-fetal pregnancies, so triplets, quadruplets. We have had triplets up here. It's been a few years, but it was kind of fun. A couple years ago, there was triplets, and then about 6 months later, I was at Costco. You know, I can tell I don't shop a lot in Costco. Anyway, I was at Costco, and there they were. It was really fun to see them in their, like, the maxi stroller. As I said, when infertility treatment, you know, it's been around since the early 80s, and in the beginning, it was kind of like a lot of things. It was like, oh, if we can blast you with a little bit, let's give you a whole lot more. And so you were seeing these multiple pregnancies, you know, 5, 6, 7, and 8. Now the technology is better, the monitoring is better, and so oftentimes, especially in a lot of fertility clinics that do IVF, they won't replace more than one fertilized ovum, or maybe two. But I have seen where someone had two fertilized ova replaced, and then one split into identical twins. So she actually had a singleton and a set of twins all in one pregnancy. So that's the kind of stuff that's always kind of fascinating to read about. Triplets, you can see they don't occur real often naturally, but they can. Again, they can be identical or they can be fraternal. I have seen, you know, heard of identical sets of triplets. Yeah, and now I need to change this because now most clinics, they've actually self-regulated themselves down to two. You know, interesting thing about IVF clinics is they're not really regulated by anybody. And so they can choose to do what they want. And oftentimes what they want to do is report high numbers of pregnancies. So any pregnancy that's positive, even if it's an early pregnancy test, positive, they call that a pregnancy. But a lot of times patients don't always realize that doesn't mean a completed pregnancy. So that gets into a whole other lecture about infertility. I want to make just a quick comment what a fetal reduction is. We will rarely see this anymore, but back in the days when they would replace a lot of embryos, if some were found to not be growing well on ultrasound, the parents were offered the option of actually, they would locate that one on ultrasound and inject some potassium and
what that would do is it would cause that fetus's heart to stop beating. And I can tell you that's a very, very difficult situation for parents to face because they tried so hard to get pregnant and now they had too many and they had to make that decision. And so that's driven part of the decision making to not, that gets into a lot of ethical issues that, you know, if we can avoid them, we'd like to. And you don't see that very much anymore. This is not something I'm going to question you about on an exam, but I just want you to be aware, if you ever hear that term, what that means. And fortunately, we don't see it much anymore. So, risks of a multi-fetal pregnancy. Well, she's got all the risks that we've talked about throughout the semester. You know, she's got an increased risk of diabetes, increased risk of hypertension, increased risk of early delivery. Because she's got an increase in the blood volume even greater than a normal pregnancy, there's an increase in cardiovascular issues. So again, stroke, high blood pressure. Certainly she's gonna have edema. You know, some of these women with, you know, multiple pregnancies, those abdomens, I don't know if they can stretch much more. Obviously, anemia with uterine distension. So again, that over-distended uterus, what's the number one thing you're going to anticipate as a complication? Hemorrhage, yeah, postpartum hemorrhage, higher risk. Certainly, they can be at risk for placenta previa or abruption. Prematurity is often a given. So again, are there any twins in the NICU? Twins or at all? Is there a set in there?
There were three sets of twins when I was in there.
Okay. What was their gestation? Do you remember?
The ones that I was working with were born at 32.
Okay.
And I don't know about the other two sets.
Okay.
With them.
Okay. So.
Who set was they gonna? 30. That one I was in.
Okay. Okay. So 30, 32. So again, like I said, we don't often like to think about the dollars and cents, but you know, a NICU admission times two, so. It's just, that's why we'd like to prevent that. Yes.
Does like the boundaries for like maturity change at all with our gestational age, or like what we want desired for like twins or triplets change at all from just having the single?
We'd still like them to go as close to term as possible. Is that what you're asking?
I guess, yeah. But like, how common is it that you get twins going to 40 weeks?
Not very often. Yeah. Usually, I mean, again, it depends on the size of the babies, the health of mom, the age of mom, so many factors. But you don't usually hear of twins going to full term. But sometimes they do. You know, I've seen deliveries of like 2 6- or 7-pound twins. So again, that's like carrying around a 13-pound baby. Yeah. So. That's why I said people get really excited about twins until you know, you're the nurse and you know all this stuff. And yeah, that's why anybody working in OB gets nervous about multiple pregnancies. They're at higher risk for congenital malformations or possibly having just a 2-vessel versus a 3-vessel cord. So, you know, usually what you'll see in terms of management during pregnancy, yeah, here it is. So first thing, ideally you'll identify the correct number of fetuses by ultrasound early in pregnancy. So again, you all know I'm not a young nurse, you know, I've been around for just a few years. But when I started working, ultrasound really didn't exist. And I was working in the little 10-bed hospital. I got lots of, I call them my war stories from up there. But a woman came in, and she was quite petite, quite tiny, and, you know, she was going to deliver, and that was back when we took you to the delivery room and put you on a flat table, and we got one baby delivered, and they thought the placenta was coming, and guess what showed up? Baby number two, and literally the dad passed out in the delivery room, so he didn't get injured. Anyway, I still see him in the news every so often because he's got a job for the state now, and I always think of that. But anyway, you want to identify early on, you know, how many fetuses are there, and you want, real, like we do in any pregnancy, we want an accurate date of delivery. But probably these patients, we're going to see them more frequently. So instead of that usual schedule that we follow for everybody, this may be a patient that's going to be coming in for more frequent ultrasounds, possibly non-stress tests, you know, especially if she develops any complications. Really, weight gain, we don't expect him to gain that much more, maybe about, you know, 5 to 10 pounds more. Again, we're going to watch for issues, you know, just not just, you know, blood pressure, but again, diabetes, all the complications of pregnancy. Certainly these women are going to experience more back pain because, again, the uterus is supported by two round ligaments that connect into the ligaments of the back. And so, again, if we get that lower distension of the uterus, you know, sometimes they'll compensate, they'll get that sway back, and it causes a lot of back pain. And so, you know, a number of years ago, somebody finally got the ingenious idea to actually develop a little support band for these moms to wear, because it can be a lot of weight for her to support. Varicosities, you know, they're just going to be at higher risk. And by the way, you know, that is genetic. So if any of your parents, male or female, and this applies to everybody in here who's male or female, had varicosities, you are at higher risk. So I always say my best words of advice is when you go to work, you start your career, wear really good. You know, now we have a lot of great options for those fun, funky support hose and good shoes, because that'll help. Won't prevent it, but it does help. These patients might be put on bed rest after 20 weeks of gestation, but there again, we've got to weigh the risks and the benefits. So not always. But I think the biggie is preparing them for all the, you know, having a baby can be overwhelming, especially if it's your first baby, and now suddenly you're going to bring home more than one baby. But likewise, I've seen families where they maybe had two children and just wanted to have one more, and now they're going to have two or three more. And so it's just a lot, and that's why you see a lot of support groups. You know, there's one in Billings, it's called Moms of Multiples, and I think there's a lot of, you know, get-togethers for people that have twins. We don't see so many, you know, in vitro, you know, higher number of pregnancies here. As I said, they've got higher rates of complications, more likely to have preterm birth, low birth weight, you know, small for gestational age, or those very low birth weight. Certainly, shoulder dystocia is a big issue. Sometimes you'll see, some providers will not even do vag delivery of twins. But some will, and I have seen instances where first baby comes, normal presentation, and great, and second baby comes and either is a transverse presentation or a shoulder dystocia, and you know, she could end up with a C-section. So that's why if you're caring for these patients, you really got to kind of be prepared for anything. Cord prolapse with the second fetus can happen. So again, that's important. Twin-to-twin transfusion syndrome. So basically what that is where one twin really is kind of being the little piggy. They get more of the blood flow. And that, and we did have this, I don't think it was this semester, I think it was last spring, there was actually a set of twins up there with twin-to-twin transfusion syndrome. And the one twin was almost 2 pounds more in birth weight than the other one. Again, placental problems, congenital anomalies. As I said, oftentimes these are the patients that they're just scheduled for a C-section. You worry about hypertension, anemia, hemorrhage. So really, pregnancy, we're worried about all the other things, but just our alert system goes up to the next level. So, all right, so we don't have, I know I said this already, I just like to wrap things up. No class next Monday, but then 2 weeks we'll have our perinatal loss and grief. I have to tell you, every semester students tell me that's one of their favorite things. It's a hard subject.
but parents come and they're very heartfelt and they really love to come and talk to you as future nurses. So even if you're never going to work OB, I think you're going to pick up some insights that you'll use just about anywhere. So have a good 2 weeks until I see you, and otherwise my clinical group, see you this week.